Hi, I'm Randy Samberg. You can find me at vegansforpeace.org as well as quotesonslavery.org, and you're listening to Coexisting with Non-Human Animals.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Vegetarian.
Vegan.
Yeah,
well. Let's get it right.
You used the word animals, but I suppose what you should have said is non-human animals. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then make a
change. Hi everyone, welcome to episode 53 of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals, Animal Rights and Rights. Promoting veganism or animal rights and not rights. Promoting welfare reform. First, I'd like to share an email from a listener. Hello from Costa Rica. My name is Gloriana Rodriguez. I am now a strict vegan. I had been a lifelong vegetarian and become vegan recently. The simple beauty of honoring life by completely abstaining from animal products seemed to be a deeper manifestation of the values I grew up with. I discovered your podcast recently. I genuinely enjoy it. The combination of analysis and sarcastic humor with the profound message of veganism is definitely my cup of tea. Thank you very much indeed. Please continue. Regards, Gloriana. Well, thank you. It's nice to hear from people who listen. If you'd like to send me an email, my email address is jaywontdart@gmail.com. jaywontdart@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. It's nice to make new vegan friends from around the world. I have lots of good news to share, and one piece of very bad news. I'll start with the bad news. I love Grand Theft Auto Vice City. I truly believe it and San Andreas should be remade in high definition, two of the greatest video games ever. 1980s Florida, the mid-1990s California, and Nevada, so they could squeeze in Los Vegans, or whatever that little town is called. One of the best things about the Grand Theft Auto games is the radio stations. You can listen to the radio in any car while you drive over prostitutes or away from pursuing police officers. Or, you can always obey the speed limit if you want to be boring. Except for that spot in San Andreas by the mine in Los Venturas. That highway, boy, those cars and scooters and dump trucks. Every vehicle around there seems to do 200 kilometers an hour. It's nuts. My Ford GT40 or Honda NSX can barely keep up. Regardless of how fast and unlawfully you drive, the radio always plays back the same, with irritatingly loud, aggressive rock stations, whiny, pathetic, country music stations, and the porridge is just right stations of hip-hop, pop, and fake talkback. In Vice City, cruising 1980s Miami in your Lamborghini Countach, bought from a shady character, a Mr. Tim Geyer, who's wearing a vivid Hawaiian shirt and a thick gold medallion, across his open chest of dark curly hair. Pulling up to the mansion from Scarface, you can listen to this song. I just died in your arms tonight. Must have been something you said. I just died in your arms tonight. On the 24th of April 2011 New Zealand time, Mr. Rooster died. He was one of the best friends anyone could have ever asked for. He was soft, gentle, and a fantastic family member to my chicken friends. He had an infection and slowly became paralysed over the course of an hour. He died in my arms after I'd been keeping him warm, giving him food and water, using a needleless syringe to put drops of water into his beak, and keeping him company. I've had other chickens die this way before. I managed to save one hen by keeping her safe and warm, making sure she was okay, and she recovered. Now two have died from this condition. I have three hen friends still alive, no rooster. I have the two yellow hens, the one with black spots on her tail feathers, and the seemingly much larger all-yellow hen, and black chick. I hope they will all be okay without a rooster finding food for them. Gee, that does sound sexist, right? Well, in the case of chickens, roosters really do behave overbearingly man of the house. They watch over the hens as they eat, often after finding the food and calling them to it. Mr. Rooster was even so nice as to find food, to hold still, and let them take it from his beak. I'd done everything I could for him. The general advice I've been given is that they are as good as dead when they're in that state, that you can try separating them from the other chickens, keep them warm, clean and dry, make sure they are eating and drinking, but that they will probably die. I was very upset. I made a few videos with him as we sat in the sun together, a small towel on my lap with him bundled up after being given a wash. Around his tail feathers was very dirty, part of the sickness. Warm water cleaned them right up. I patted him with one hand while talking gently to him. I was taking the videos partly because I take videos of them all quite often, and to show other people his condition, how I was dealing with it. I do have a video of him as he died. He was quiet. He had a couple of fits, made a squeak, and died in my arms, eyes open. I knew he had died almost instantly. I guess his whole body changed. Maybe he went limp all over. I don't know, but I could just tell that that was the end of Mr. Rooster. I waited a while, stroking him and telling him I loved him, before closing his eyes with my fingers. I left him in the sun, lying on the towel for a little longer, before burying him under a silver birch tree, next to Miss Hen. I'd kept several of her long black feathers from when she was alive. I wouldn't pluck any of their feathers out ever, even if they were dead and they were not going anywhere. Just a mark of respect. Nobody plucks my chicken friends. Their bodies are theirs, not mine. I don't inherit their body feathers when they die. I took one of my few feathers from Miss Hen and put it gently into Mr. Rooster's wing. Sort of lame, I know, but it was a sign that they were together again. You know, side by side under the silver birch tree, that is. Probably more for me than them. I don't believe in the supernatural. I know quite well where they are. I've buried them both myself under a favourite childhood tree. I know they loved me very much. They both ate from my hand and followed me, and I loved them. They are gone, they are not coming back, and I can accept that. I won't pretend and tell myself otherwise. They live on, in our memories and the photos and videos I have of them, that many people from around the world have seen. I hope that these recordings can help other human beings see that chickens are just like us, in all the ways that matter, that they are not a something, but a someone, that they have obvious emotions, that they love, and are worthy of being loved in return. When Miss Hen died, I took one of the feathers she'd dropped while alive and put it in a gap in the chicken shed. It's sticking out from the wall in a crack. So, in my silly sentimental way, the other hens, they could always see it while they nested at night. I don't know if chickens remember their dead. I know they care for each other in life. They could easily see that black feather on the white wall that's always been there from Miss Hen. If they realised it was from her, great. If not, well, I knew it was hers. I added one of Mr. Rooster's, one he'd dropped while alive, crossing each other. If they remember the appearance, that's marvellous. If they don't, the worst case scenario, I do, and I can see those feathers each day while spending time with the living chicken friends. I didn't cry while Miss Hen or Mr. Rooster died. It's always been my way to keep it inside, along with rhyming. It's also the right thing to do, right? To bottle up your emotions, deep down inside, in that tiny black hole where they can never, 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 never get out. Good. I thought so. I loved them while they were alive. I did all I could to be a good friend, to keep them safe, and to help them while they were sick. When I found Miss Hen dead, I couldn't help her. When a yellow hen, and later Mr. Rooster, died on my lap, / in my arms, there wasn't anything I could do. I miss them all very much, and think of them often. Thank you for hearing me out. I thought about it while I heard Mr. Rooster's body. We kill over 56 billion land animals each year. Over 49 billion of those are chickens, who are no less special than my Miss Hen or Mr. Rooster. No less than my chicken friends. How could I tell others how I felt, when the majority of my human friends are non-vegan, that they think nothing of paying a couple dollars for a healthy chicken to be killed, and for what? Because they've grown up doing so? For a few minutes of chewing on their body and throwing their bones in the trash? And that's after their legs and heads have already been cut off, their guts scooped out, they've been frozen and shipped and cut up. All because we've been doing this for quite some time to them. Again, thank you for listening to me, those of you not smart enough to realize you could have fast-forwarded through all my whinging. Thanks for those few minutes of your precious time. That's the reason I'll always be single, because New Zealand women, gee, it's great to generalize, isn't it? They don't put up with any of that sentimental crap in men. That's why the original Cutting Crew version couldn't be successful if originally released in 2011. It's too whiny, too emotional. Men can't show those feelings outside of the 1980s. Come on! No, if they released that song now, it would have to be pitch shifted up, the vocals processed, some fat bass added, and perhaps rap lyrics too. I actually prefer this Jay-Z sampling. My truth, the business hate me cause the industry ain't make me. Hustlers and boosters embrace me and the music I be making. I dumb down for my audience to double my dollars. They criticize me for it, yet they all yell holler. If skill sold, truth be told, I'd probably be lyrically Talib Kweli. Truthfully, I wanna rhyme like Common Sense, but I did 5 mil. I ain't been rhyming like Common Sense. When your sense got that much in common and you've been hustling since your inception. Go with what makes sense. Since I know what I'm up against, we as rappers must decide what's most important. And I can't help the poor if I'm one of them. So I got rich and gave back to me, that's the win-win. So next time you see the homie in his rims spin, just know my mind is working just like them. And let's go a step beyond 1980s synthesizers. Let's auto-tune our voices like Mr. T-Pain and rap about cars, money, alcohol, and the woman who appreciates such men. You know, the real men.
White forces, new money, white Porsches, blue money, I like bosses, white frames, same as Scott Storch's, gold bottles, hit the forge with top models.
Exactly. Now, no couple minute audio file could ever sum up your feelings for someone you love dearly, but we can use something symbolic. There's plenty of songs about young African-American boys, surnamed Jackson, who have mouse friends called Ben, but what of birds? Well, apparently inspired from this song from 1965. Child, they call a duck. Hey, Lord, you run down to the river. Come on, baby. Then you get a duck. Try your luck. Oh, Lord, you start to flap your wings. Come on, baby. Try till you get enough. Do the duck. Now, come on, baby. Come on, baby. Come on, baby. Come on, baby. You know you're looking so. Come on, so good now. All right. Do the duck. Ow! Hey, that's actually not bad. Not bad at all. However, it spawned this monstrosity from the year 1976. Roger, Carolyn, I'm sure you'll remember this bloody awful abomination. All the ladies were treating me right, moving my feet to the disco beat. How in the world could I keep my seat? Look at me, I'm the disco. reminds me of that awful movie, Howard the Duck. The 70s have a lot to answer for, preferably at The Hague. A duck who declares, gotta have me a woman, and does that perverted, Muttley-style wheezing snicker, try your luck, don't be a cluck? Cripes. But it established a naming convention, music genre, bird name. Well, we can tweak that a little, making it gender-specific, and for modern dance music. Why, we'd have the house music hen friend, the rave party rooster. Roosters are proud, extravagant animals, proud of themselves. Mr. Rooster wouldn't want some sappy ballad to his memory. He'd want a blistering techno-trance song, with strobing lasers and fog machines, naturally. I hear this remix and think of a small rooster, who liked eating falafel off my plate, who always ran to see me when I returned home, who would find food for the hens, letting them take it from his beak and keeping his family safe. I hope that you'll hear that too, a victorious little rooster, or at least a sample of gorillas.
Are you here with me? Just looking out on the day of another dream, where you can't get what you want, but you can get me. So let's set out to see love, 'cause you are my medicine when you're close to me. When you're close to me,
despite the trendy techno tinge to this tribute, I'll be staying single. I'll still love and care for my remaining chicken friends and tell everyone about it. Let's listen to how much he enjoyed falafel. Here he is cautiously taking it off my plate and telling the other chickens it's great. He shared it with them afterwards while they were all on the ground and I could give each their share. I'll add a link to my YouTube videos where you can see Mr. Rooster, www.youtube.com/jaywontdart. JAYWONTDART. I'll share it around on Facebook and my blog.
Chickens like falafel.
I loved you, Mr. Rooster. Time for some more positive, less whiny and less emotional news. I'm working on several projects for the Invercargill Vegan Society, such as a proper website for InverSoc and coexisting with non-human animals, and perhaps some logoed items, more about those in coming episodes. I've also bought some domains, www.coexistingwithnonhumananimals.co.nz for a New Zealand website, that's coexistingwithnonhumananimals.co.nz, no blog spot anymore, In fact, I might move away from Blogger altogether, going to a crappy WordPress site instead, without address, coexisting with nonhumananimals.co.nz. I'm enjoying the projects I have in the pipeline, and I hope to have some actual members in Invercargill soon. I'm planning on meeting at least two other vegans who live in my city. It's not just me feeling sorry for myself. Let's be upbeat. We've got plenty to do. Lots of non-vegans to convert with our V-rays, especially the young. Get them while they're young and impressionable, with those nice, soft skulls so permeable to veganizing rays. Another thing that influences the young, radio DJs, the ones that still listen to the radio anyway, Dr. Roger Yates, official sociologist of the Invercargill Vegan Society. Put that on your CV, Roger. He had some time to kill, and so put up with me forcing my way onto his show on human-non-human relations. Here was one of my suggestions for his The Boring Old Bit. Since we both pretend to be on the radio, why not combine our quirks for a solid 30 seconds of shock jock mayhem? Well, turns out his doctor, I forget who exactly, the doctor intro idea was better. Nevertheless, here it is.
Hey guys, it's John and Wyatt, keeping you entertained on the weekday drive time slot. In the morning, keep that dial locked on INVSOC FFFFFFFM. Throwing it back to Dr. Yates, oh yeah. Dr. Yates, who gave up the dream of making min wage on American radio doing Liverpool accents to get a gig as professor of sociology. How'd that work out for you, Roger?
Which brings us, of course, to the final spot, which is, look out, here's the boring old fart, who wanted to be a DJ when he was a child, didn't have the brains to get together like John Peel, get together a Liverpool accent, go to America and become famous. Spot.
You can find Roger's fabulous show, with all the bells and whistles, at www.human-nonhuman.blogspot.com or on iTunes, on Human-Non-Human Relations. This episode, I'd like to discuss a recent New Zealand radio panel on the show ARW, Animal Rights and Wrongs, the topic being vegans promoting veganism or vegans promoting welfare reform. I found it quite exciting to listen to. I've been looking forward to that week's episode, and I hope you'll enjoy it too. Here are some clips from that episode of Animal Rights and Wrongs from April 9th, 2011.
Kia ora, this program is brought to you by New Zealand On Air and Wellington Access Radio. Make your voice heard.
Animal Rights and Wrongs is a weekly program covering animal welfare, their rights and exploitation. Sponsored by Opportunity for Animals, 4 Bay Road, Kilburnie and 90 Riddiford Street, Newtown. Both stores are in Wellington and sell good quality used clothing and small household items, with funds going towards helping animals in need. The Animal Rights and Wrongs show, presented by Deborah Ashton and Eric Wolfe, every Saturday from 11 a.m. on Wellington Access Radio, 783 a.m. Pushing welfare reforms over promoting veganism or abolition, confronting campaigns versus the polite approach. These are some of the questions about actual campaign strategy. Now, in our quest to stop the exploitation of animals, I guess the first question is, what is our goal? And the second one is, what is the best way to achieve this sooner than later? For example, do we campaign in steps and begin with better welfare conditions for animals, or do we holler from the highest mountain and call for an immediate stop to all types of animal abuse and demand that the whole world immediately go vegan? Now, some would argue the latter, but the question is, will this scare off mainstream people and put us in the nutcase box, causing us to achieve even less? Others say that finding different ways to raise animals only to end up on the dinner plate anyway is far too slow and is still making it okay for animals to be abused. Now, I listened to Vegan for Life podcast episode 9, where Emmy James interviewed former Hamilton radio host Sam Tucker. Safe were heralding a victory in having South Stalls banned late last year, and while this still will take a few more years to kick in and farrowing crates are still legal, Sam had an issue with the way the campaign was run, because he said that Safe did not mention the option for people to not eat pigs at all, or even that the campaign didn't really promote veganism. He said that the frontman for the campaign, comedian Mike King, was seen promoting and eating free-range pork on television, and that this led to people believing that vegans thought it was okay for consumers to still eat pork as long as it was free-range, sending confusing messages. He added that the animals were still killed and kept as property just as much as any free-range animals, you know, whether they were free-range or they were kept in intensively farmed conditions. Sam also criticised the RNZ SPCA's campaign against battery hen farming and sow crates, which they actually went into his own school. And he was critical of this because he said that students were told you don't have to give up your eggs and bacon, you just have to eat free range.
An interesting topic, to be sure. I entirely agree with Sam. Now, we know what to expect from the SPCA, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which, as we know, really means pat the cat and be nice to the family dog while feeding them the ground and chopped up and blended corpses of chickens and cows from the SPCA's own brand of pet food. It makes me sick thinking about it. A group supposedly out to prevent cruelty to animals while killing my chicken friends and cows and probably other animals too. We know that's what the SPCA stands for, but what about Safe? Sam mentioned that Safe should really stand up for animal rights and not welfare. They portray themselves as animal rights, but almost always ask for larger cages or for animals to be kept a certain way, you know, before we kill them. Here's the bit where I pretend I've never heard this panel discussion before. Gee, I sure would like to know what their opinions are on this matter. I wonder how we could possibly find out. Maybe if some guy played the clips right now.
Well, to give us their opinion on the best way to put a stop to animal exploitation is Dr. Michael Morris, Lindsay Wilcox and Chris Noaro. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show. Now, what is our ultimate goal, Michael? I guess I'll start with you. What do you think the ultimate goal is in the interest of animal exploitation?
So the ultimate goal is to have animals treated with the same sort of respect that we theoretically, if not in practice, treat humans, saying that they, all of them have some fairly basic rights, including the right not to be exploited, eaten or arbitrarily killed.
What about you, Lindsay? What's your thought?
Yeah, the ultimate goal is for nobody to be consuming any animal products at all. That's what I think is the ultimate goal. We just want to get rid of all the industries concerned with animals.
And what about you, Chris?
Yeah, I agree with those goals. I think that we should be presenting the cruelty-free lifestyle as straightforward as possible. I think that in separate areas, people can understand that various things like, for example, nutritional science, environmentalism, the damage that it's doing to the environment, and morality are on our side, and so we should be firm in our stance in promoting the cruelty-free lifestyle.
I can agree with that too. I want to live in a world without anyone being hurt, be they human animals or non-human animals. Let's see how we can get to that point.
Well, the debate about campaign strategy has gone on for as long as I can remember, and I know that as a campaigner myself, I've often grappled with the best approach to do this. For me, Safe were the driving force behind a ban in sow stalls, and the results, of course, have spoken for themselves. And I did actually see Mike King as an opportunity for an animal rights organisation to be able to connect with mainstream New Zealanders. What are your thoughts on the way that Safe handle campaigns like this? Are they doing it right, or do you think that they should be more outspoken and promote veganism, or do you think that should be left to other groups?
They're stuck in that spot again that we always talk about over and over, where they rely on all these donations, and when they're seen to be promoting something that's looking at, you know, a radical type thing that people think we are, not eating any animals, the donations, how are they going to survive if they're not going to have those donations coming in? They're in between a rock and a hard place, aren't they? They want the donations, they actually want things to go vegan, but they don't, you know, they've got that, they're just stuck in that spot, I think. It's the same for the places in Australia and here, the SPCA and the RSPCA, same story. They need the money to come in.
Do large groups really need donations to help other animals? Actually, do we even need large groups? Surely there's some appeal in having hundreds of groups across the world, of all sizes, speaking in their area for veganism? Why do we need large groups with full-time staff, buildings, electricity bills, vehicles, and annual donation events? We can have just as much, perhaps far greater reach on a budget of $0 and 0 cents online, and through passionate people, doing what they love. I'm looking at getting a hosted website soon. That's about $100 New Zealand per year, another $20 for the domain name, $120 per year for each group's website. It's really not that much, especially if all members put some money towards it. Plus pamphlets in our time. Surely, it's never been easier to promote respect for everyone.
Do you think that Sam's criticism is justified, though?
I'd like to pass on to Michael, so I need to think about it. Yeah, it's a difficult question, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Sam was criticising the RNZ SPCA. They're not a rights organisation, they're an animal welfare organisation, so they were quite consistent with their own views.
I think it's worth exploring. I think animal rights groups should focus on promoting animal rights, but animal welfare groups? Well, don't be making buggy whips for abusing horses when Mr. Ford puts out that quality American automobile. Do we even need animal welfare groups anymore? What do they do? Promote harsh penalties for people who throw stones at a cat or dog, while making their money from selling chopped up animals, selling their non-existent souls to flesh companies, Freedom Foods and SPCA approved?
His criticism of SAFE is probably at least more reasonable here, because they are a rights organisation, they're a vegan organisation, and they're not promoting veganism. But it is always a question of idealism versus reality, and the campaign has been successful.
Has it really, though? How do we determine a success or failure with welfare campaigns? It's a success because these pigs will be out of one kind of cage, supposedly, starting in a few years? Is that worth spending millions of dollars on, not to mention time and effort? I think there's much to be said about animal welfare victories promoting more non-veganism, not more veganism, more non-veganism, because non-vegans feel better about what they are doing. Oh, it's okay to buy this product because it's humane, it's kind, it's good, it's welfare approved, it's lovely, it's great, it's normal, it's the right thing to do. The issue of not killing other animals for our enjoyment or profit isn't mentioned. The idea that it's wrong to hurt and kill other sentient beings, it's not mentioned. That may sound more complicated to explain. I don't think it needs to be difficult to understand. Just think of how we explain why we are vegan to those curious. I'd say something like, other animals are my friends, and I think it's very wrong to hurt or kill them, especially when it's not necessary. I'd then show those interested photos and videos of my chicken friends, focusing on why veganism is positive, why we should all be vegan, and not the opposite, welfare-orientated view, which is why we should not do X, the graphic undercover videos that have been edited. And here the worker abuses the pig with a broken vodka bottle. Do you want to be responsible for this? Look at the cockroaches running up the walls. Do you feel good about yourself? Do you want to feel good about yourself? Then pay a dollar more, and know you've bought your place in heaven with Happy Flesh Farms. Friendship is not hard to understand. Small children, day-old chickens, can understand trust and love. Why do adults move away from these simple realizations? We can focus on friendship, respect, and treating others the way we'd like to be treated ourselves. We really can. You don't have to believe in a divine Superman to believe in yourself, to believe in what's right. Just so long as you don't really believe you can fly, that usually ends up bad. Veganism is not an ideal, it's a reality.
Mike King is not SAFE, and he's never pretended to be vegan, he's never pretended to be part of SAFE, but using him as a frontman has done a lot more for pigs than possibly if we'd used other vegans who are not as well known as Mike as a sort of quintessential Kiwi bloke.
I don't think Mike King made the campaign successful. We all know Mike King was not vegan. The average New Zealander who saw him on news shows or on ads for SAFE, he truly was speaking for SAFE. He was talking about, don't buy cruel pork, don't buy caged pork, it's wrong. Even when he didn't explicitly state, I only eat free range. When we say, I don't buy factory farmed, Most people wouldn't take that as, oh, you're vegan then. No, I believe they see the two choices as normal flesh and free-range/cage-free flesh. It's not a non-veganism versus veganism issue. The main Sunday program covering all this sow crates, crawl factory farming business featured very close-up shots of Mike King frying the flesh of these poor pigs and eating them. It made me feel sick to watch. And really, you can't argue with the man himself. Here's a clip from that episode of Sunday.
And what about Mike King? Has his investigation put him off pork?
No, I still love pork, and why wouldn't I try that?
Well, I thought the experiences in that place might have put you off.
No, the experience put me off eating caged pork. This is free-range pork. This style of farming is acceptable, and cage farming isn't. And if we want to make a difference, we should eat this type of pork rather than the cage pork.
Next up, Piggy Sue, the crate-farmed pig, wins her first taste of freedom.
No, I still love pork, and why wouldn't I? Try that. That is not the actions of an animal rights activist, and it surely shouldn't be the frontman for an animal rights group. What are they? Pork, and he loves it. And why wouldn't I? Where to begin? As an animal rights activist, I'd say that that pork, as you called it, was the body of a sentient being who loved life just as much as you or I do, who mattered just as much as we do, and who was killed for our pleasure because we love killing tens of billions of animals each year for no other real reason than tradition. We've grown up believing this is okay and the perceived pleasure we get from it. And how do we stop this behaviour? By saying we are against it. If the actual frontman for this Ban Cages campaign wasn't moved to veganism by being in the actual farms, touching these pigs while they were still alive, living like that, why would his testimonial move other non-vegans towards veganism? The experience put me off caged pork. This is free range. This style of farming is acceptable, and cage farming isn't. If the Invercargill Vegan Society had been hiring that guy to speak for us, we as in me and my chicken friends, we'd have him lining up for a government benefit faster than three small hen friends could peck and scratch a non-vegan's legs. True, Mr. King didn't hand the reporters bits of dead bodies, served hot during actual safe ads. However, that Sunday program was probably the largest single resource in the campaign, and it showed him being very far from an animal rights activist. The safe ads featuring Mike King had him again saying he was against crawl pork. He was for getting pigs out of those crawl cages, which basically means free range or cage free. However you look at it, Mike King is clearly not vegan. He's shown being non-vegan, and the group hiring him knew that and kept him on. The campaign was not for veganism. It was for not buying the bad flesh, and as an animal rights activist, founder of an animal rights group, I strongly disagree with promoting the exploitation of other animals, of killing my friends, whoever they might be.
That's right, as soon as you get somebody really famous, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, was somebody suggested this to me, I wish it was my idea, but it isn't, that we need to get the All Black trainer to go vegan, and, you know, good heavens, New Zealand would be vegan overnight if, you know, the All Blacks could have some vegan people in there. This is what turns people, big influence people, those people on the television. You know, that's why they use Mike King, but I don't agree with, you know, showing him eating free-range pork. But, you know, to get to where we want to go quickly, in my opinion anyway, and this is a great idea, somebody gave it me, whoever you are, thank you. I'd like to be able to say who it was, I can't remember. You know, somebody right there in the public eye that New Zealanders worship and adore, and the guy's vegan, you know, we could have veganism overnight here.
That sounds great, Lindsay, although I always recommend against going for vegan celebrities, because they almost always end up being not really vegan. Oh, there goes Jordan being the vegan police. No, not at all. We'll have an appearance from them later. I do think vegans should promote a consistent vegan message, though, and if we build up a huge vegan celebrity when they are selling copies of their latest book faster than people can realise, hey, why the hell are we buying non-toilet intended paper in 2011, making millions while doing so? Well, they should at least be vegan while preparing for retirement at age 30. And about turning people, I just have to share this clip from 1988 with Ian McKellen, you know, Gandalf from those lovely New Zealand movies. He's proud of his sexuality, Gandalf. I mean, Sir Ian McKellen. He's homosexual and promotes respect for everyone, regardless of if you like men or if you like women. Here we have some conservative MP going on about homosexuals being blatantly homosexual and how this could turn people gay. He didn't need to cite scientific evidence of this. It's just goddamn true, dammit. We just have to believe this guy, an expert on homosexuality, despite not being gay himself and with an attitude like his, no doubt having very few homosexual friends.
And that should stop in a civilized society. I think that as a result of the toleration, the decriminalization of homosexuality, the faction of the homosexual community have seen fit, and I think very mistakenly, to say not only must this activity be permitted and tolerated, but it must actually be glorified and said to be certainly the equal of the heterosexual life, if not the superior. And I think this is a deplorably ill-advised, because I think that it was liked it to, and I think it probably has, created a feeling of ill will against homosexuality, which would otherwise never have existed.
Neil McCallum.
There is certainly a great deal of ill will, and it's based on the sort of inaccuracies which I'm afraid you've just been guilty of. There was no one trying to promote homosexuality with that book. It was there as an aid in discussing homosexuality. I would have to challenge you to quote the medical authority which supports you in assuming that people can be pushed into homosexuality and as a teenager, or indeed pushed into heterosexuality. It didn't work with me. I wasn't pushed into heterosexuality, and you clearly have not been pushed into homosexuality.
Yeah, McKenna,
you must tell me what is your basis for believing that.
I will answer the question. I went to an English boarding school where homosexuality, perhaps faute de mieux, was very much a practice, and it was touch and go, I think, with a number of people, whether they continued to be homosexual or ceased, and that this could be very much affected by a glamorous master, by particular teaching. I mean, I do think that you can be affected in this way.
Let us return to
that. Is at the heart of the matter whether homosexuality can be promoted and taught, and people can be converted to it. It is just not true what has been asserted. Of course, during teenagers, children experiment. According to Kinsey, which is the only basic, the only reliable figures we have, 30% of the population have homosexual experiences, and before they decide whether they are homosexual or not. That is perfectly natural and normal, and I don't think should necessarily be discouraged.
Ian McKenna,
it's certainly not going to be caused by a book.
Some people are lucky enough to be born vegan, into vegan families. Others decide to be vegan on their own accord. They are turned vegan. Which, unlike pamphlets saying, it's normal for you to be homosexual. Some people are heterosexual, others are homosexual. You are who you are. Vegan resources can turn you vegan. Unfortunately, vegans are not yet seen as corrupting an influence as campaigners for equal human rights to love. I'm rather disappointed. I won't be happy until I have pastors picketing my house, declaring, "And the Jesus man blew up the city of vegans because their sinning recognition of sentience was the work of the devil himself." It would be great if more famous people are vegan, and that includes All Blacks, that little sports team of ours. But really, a vegan is a vegan. Who cares how well known you are? I don't think it matters to my chicken friends when we hurt and kill them, if they were hurt and killed for their bodies to be eaten by a celebrity or not. My chicken friends wouldn't know if I was famous. They like me for who I am inside. Let's focus on promoting veganism to everyone.
Just going back to strategy again, I'm just wondering if welfare campaigns where they are talking about better conditions for animals that are still going to end up on the dinner plate or their byproducts are. Aren't those campaigns just making people feel a bit better about killing animals rather than reducing the numbers of animals that are actually being killed? Because, you know, how often do you hear people say, "Oh, I only buy free range," and it's like they can just hide away from any sort of guilt that an animal will suffer at the end of the day for them to eat the animal or the byproduct, and still have to be slaughtered. So do you think that's really achieving, animal welfare campaigns are really achieving what we want in the long term?
I think you have to take people where they are. So if you've got some people who say, yes, I only buy free range, that's great, see if we can get them to the next level. But if you've got people who are sort of meat and three veggies and who would never even think of animal welfare, even getting them to think about where their animals are coming from and getting them to the free range stage, that would be an achievement.
I think promoting free range and other such products of animal exploitation is a bad idea, when we can be promoting animal rights, friendship and respect instead. If people find it radical at first, okay, we can continue talking to those interested right now, building a movement so that soon, veganism won't be seen as radical at all, that the two choices will not be 20 beatings a day versus 19 beatings a day, the one less beating given to each animal, the result of decades of campaigning and millions of dollars. No, it would be between veganism and non-veganism. And I truly believe that a large number of my generation know what a vegan is. Imagine when it's normal to see vegan restaurants in each and every city in the world, when it's common to have vegan friends. We can get to that point very soon. And I say that as someone who's only ever met three vegans in person in his whole life. I'm very optimistic. I see that as realistic.
So you think that campaigns should be more targeted at going vegan?
I do, because we only have to look at just, we have to pick health and environment without all the animal discussions to say that, well, I say to people now, they say to me, I can't be vegan. I say, sorry, but you will be soon. Because we're going to run out of agricultural land, we're not going to be able to produce this food for this number of people. You have no choice, you'll be vegan like me, and you know, actually, you can actually be vegan.
Well, that's being a little too direct, I think. You're going to be vegan whether you like it or not. I don't think that would go over so well here in Invercargill. Detected vegan population consisting of me and a young woman, with rumours of two or three other vegan resources yet undiscovered. I don't think we can force people into veganism, and I don't think we should act as though we know they will be forced, kicking and screaming, into veganism.
If we compare this, though, to other historical campaigns, for example, to get rid of slavery, how do you think our pace is going compared to how long it took them to get rid of slaves, for example?
Slavery's been going for about 5,000 years, and it's only in the last 150 that states have started banning it, so we're actually doing pretty well in comparison.
I think we're all very impatient, and I'm very impatient. But when you look at I was just saying last night to a friend of mine, look at the time length. When I first came to Wellington on holiday, 2002, I couldn't get soy milk in a coffee anywhere in Lower Hutt, and I walked all around, and it's only 9 years, and we've got the word vegan on menus. We've got so much has happened. It is huge, and I know it's happening. You can feel the swell of the wave. It's just too slow. But gee, that's a massive change in 9 years from what it was when I came here for a trip to what it is today in all the cafes with vegan breakfast and everything all over the place. It's hugely changed.
But what about SAFE have been campaigning, for 20-odd years to get hens out of cages? Does that not seem like an incredibly long time for us to be running a campaign?
Well, because we live limited life stage, 70 years, then 20 years is a long time, yes. But if we look at it historically, it's a very short time.
Yeah, Patty Mark started in the 70s against the battery hens. She's still going, doing the same thing. But while you've got the dollar rule still, and while we're dealing with the dollar and the governments, it's not just the fault of the campaign, is it? It's not just the campaign content or strategy. At the end of the day, the laws have to be changed by the government for us to succeed, hey?
I agree with Lindsay. We've really come a long way in a short period of time. I can look around and see the greater use of the term vegan in printed media, while it's still around, on websites and among my friends. I remember being with non-vegan friends while the top music single was played on TV, a song by 303. It might have been the number one song in New Zealand at the time. My non-vegan friends were sitting on leather couches and singing along, "Tell your boyfriend, if he wants beef, that I'm a vegetarian and I ain't scared of him. She wanna touch me, woo, she wants to love me, woo, she'll never leave me, woo, woo." You know the one. It was really weird, just like my singing. And while it was vegetarian, not vegan, in time it will be the other V word that the musicians prominently mention in number one singles. We'll get used to veganism in the mainstream. There will be more vegan options available. There will be more vegans. And all of this is occurring right now.
So how do campaigns channel those then? How do they get those messages out? Because a lot of our campaigns are based around animal cruelty.
I generally just go straight for the guts, you know, and I go, oh, a dropper full of pus in every glass of milk, did you know that? And do they want to know what they're eating or don't they want to know? Don't they care what they're actually eating? Mm. Casein and pus in every glass of milk, come on.
I've seen that in the supermarket.
I'm straight in for the, you know, into the jugular.
Yeah. That's good for a start, but then they say, okay, what should I do instead? Then you actually have to give them practical advice, because all our cooking classes, for instance, are all about meat. You know, what they'd have learnt at home is about, you know, a meal's not complete without meat. Mm. You've got to actually teach them how to cook, how to look for things in the supermarket.
Yeah, I do. I can give you any recipes. Here's my email. Send me any questions or any, if you want any recipe, I can even come around and show you how to make them.
You better give out your email address here, Lindsay.
Yeah. Mm. But, I mean, hasn't the internet made that a whole lot easier?
Yeah, it has. You've got to back it up. It's no good being out there and being right in the face about what they're eating if you can't come up with a good alternative that's easy to do.
Again, Lindsay is very direct, shall we say. It's good to be enthusiastic. This is my favourite clip of Lindsay from that episode of Animal Rights and Wrongs.
You've got to have that information when you're going to, you know, to tell people it's pus in the milk and faeces in the meat. You've got to come up with the goods, haven't you?
Pus in the milk, faeces in the meat. I love it. I don't like talking about graphic or gross-out images, though. I prefer focusing on the positives of veganism, of talking about friendship, of always being rated G, suitable for all audiences.
Even a little business card with a couple of websites on it is a good idea.
That's what that guy in Invercargill's got, eh? Yeah.
Who?
Who's that?
Jordan Wyatt.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Is it perhaps easier, you know, stereotyping there a wee bit, but is it easier for a woman to be able to sit there and say that she cares about animals than perhaps men care about little fluffy animals?
I think so, yeah.
Do you think that mainstream males would feel
as a man,
it's not,
I find,
you know...
I find that difficult.
I can agree with that. I think in today's society, men are beaten and downtrodden, while our estrogen and rich superiors can do whatever they like. Example... Try being a tall young guy, walking down the main street of your city in a pink tutu. Common among women, I know, but for men, it won't end well. And that's just one everyday example of men being held back. Well, if mainstream society sees it as weird for a guy to be vegan, to care for others, to have emotions other than rage or lust, then I'm weird, but still defiantly proud to wear my pink tutu down D Street.
There might be some people who might be seriously considering, could I do this? And I think that sometimes you have to focus on the people that you might be closest to persuading. Mm-hmm. And the people who maybe are a long way off, perhaps they're the ones who are going to, may not ever make an ethical decision about it. And they might only change when the food, the meat has gone, you know, sky high prices and so on.
Well, that's right. At the stores, we just say, if you know they've got no chance, let them go and concentrate on somebody with a better chance. Don't put that time into those people who are hopeless, you know, never going to change. Go straight for people where, you know, you've got more chance of success. So we just leave those, whatever percentage it is, and we don't spend any time on them.
Because also, once you've got those people, then you've built your movement more. You've got a, you know, you're bigger in numbers.
I agree. Some people will never accept men in pink tutus. Others will. Let's do what we feel is right. And in time, others will be more accepting of our lifestyle. Let's focus on those interested in veganism, and not trying to get the attention of the people who say, go away, I'm not interested in converting to Mormonism. We'll jump right back on our black, old-fashioned bicycle, and right off to the next house.
No, I'm just thinking that the disagreement between abolitionists and what they call new welfareists is very, very acrimonious. I think one thing we should be doing is working together, and not trying to alienate ourselves. There's not enough of us that we can afford to fall out.
Well, we do work together, but we've got all different, you know, views. But we all work with SAFE, and we donate to them. We all work with each other, don't we? But we don't all stand on the street and say buy free range. I won't say that. Other people will, just like Michael said.
Yeah,
but we still all work together in Wellington, as far as I know. We work together. We want the same result, but there's different ways people think that they want to go about getting there. Lots of people want to promote free range, and I never will say that. Refuse, point blank. But we're all going to the same place, aren't we? In different ways, we're all trying to get there. So I think we pretty much do work together in Wellington.
And you think that basically then, because so many groups are coming from slightly different places, that ultimately our campaign strategy is
hitting on right on the button there, Michael. You, I think it was you saying that you've seen good results of it. Do you think ultimately we are going the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, there's always room for improvement, and there's always room for honest disagreement. What there isn't room for is casting aspersions at each other's integrity or ability or intellect because we do things differently.
I can understand that. Nobody likes feeling attacked or undermined, and especially in public. I prefer not to use terms to describe myself or others, partly because it's all above this high school graduate's head, but also because people often don't like to be called a new term, presumably in a derogatory fashion, and I can respect that. Rather than abolitionist and new welfarist, I prefer to keep things simple. Vegans who promote welfare reforms and vegans who promote veganism. I don't think either is a loaded term. Welfare reforms is neutral. It's not like factory farming, which is never used by the actual industry. It's a slander. And vegans who promote veganism, there's nothing positive or negative about that either, although I do think it's the right way to go. About using half-naked women in advertising.
I'm not looking at it from the exploitation of women point of view. That's a whole new issue. I'm looking at it, does it work?
Yes.
I think, you know, having a Kiwi bloke like Mike King, I mean, OK, that might be sexist. People do tend to listen to men, even women listen to men. They like to admit they think they don't.
Yeah, generally I hum whenever other men are talking, or else I try and talk over them, especially on Skype, because my opinion is so much more valuable than theirs, but yeah, sometimes I do listen to other men. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. I think there are times when my gender is a disadvantage when talking about veganism, as well as my age might be too. Oh, he's too young, he doesn't live in the real world. He can't possibly understand why we simply must kill these animals, which I've grown up having killed, and why we must not kill these other animals, who are ethically worth no more, but who I've grown up believing are extra special. No, you can only gain this power of telling one from the other at age 40. Other times, my age seems to be an impressive thing. People are more interested in hearing about veganism from a young man. Usually it's a little creepy when you're alone in a room filled with single women and they say something like, "I think it's really neat to meet such a special young man who is so caring and passionate about others." Usually in those situations I try to make a small smile while clutching my canvas bags, available at cost price from www.zazzle.co.nz/nzvegan. ready to throw my chair through the plate glass window and hurl myself out to safety.
But I think for someone, having someone like Mike, it seems to work more. So perhaps we need a sort of He-Man Kiwi bloke
all
who's
black.
A vegan.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. All blacks are a good idea.
I'd be far more likely to sit down and listen to a lettuce lady tell me about why I should care about animals than Mike King.
And Michael and Lindsay would obviously...
Well,
that's right. I mean,
you're talking about the rugby players. We
all identify with different people, but I think you're right. There's probably two ideas there that New Zealanders do love. A lot of New Zealanders do love All Blacks, and a number of males love women wearing lettuce sleeves. But anyway, on that note.
And some men like neither rugby, a bunch of men putting their heads between each other's legs and grunting, nor women made to wear fake plant bikinis while handing out brochures for the new high-welfare temple grand and owned and operated steakhouse down the road. These men just want to wear their pink tutus down D Street and to be left the asexual hell alone.
I was going to say, you look at the bear heads and like that Stakes one, that good on you, mate, that Southland band, maybe you get someone like that. A true Kiwi.
Good old Kiwi bloke, eh?
Gee, how do we get a Southland man to be vegan? No idea. Where could we ever find one of those? You know the ones. The ones who speak like this, who say R sounds really weird, like I work in Gore. Young men who were born at Kew Hospital weighing 6 pounds, 5 ounces, whatever those were. They live here in Invercargill, and the Southland vegan guy would probably go on and on about backwards nations who haven't caught up with the metric system, and people who didn't use Apple computers and equipment, who always found a way to turn conversations to Michael Jackson or his chicken friends. And they have chicken friends, alright, then they're not technically a good old Kiwi bloke, classed as too effeminate. Yeah, so they have to be a Southern man who's only interested in watching the rugby, asking the wife to cook the man some blinking tofu so they can continue drinking beer. Well, I'll let you know if I can find one of them. Until he's found, this can end the ARW episode clips.
Right, well, look, that's all we've got time for, but thank you so much, Michael Morris, Lindsay Wilcox and Chris Noaro, who is going to be giving us What's On in one moment.
But the fun doesn't end there. Through the magic of Skype, we are magically transported into further discussion of veganism. And with me tonight, I have three very important vegans from New Zealand. I have Deborah Ashton. How are you, Deborah?
Very good, thank you.
I have Chris Noaro. How are you, Chris?
Good, thanks, Jordan.
And Dr. Michael Morris, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And we're all three vegans from New Zealand. Well, four, including myself. And I thought it'd be interesting to share our thoughts about veganism and how we both have a show and how it's exciting to meet other vegans and talk about veganism. So I thought I'd ask Deborah some questions first. Deborah, when did you decide to be vegan?
I've sort of lost a bit of track of time, really, but I think it was probably about 8 years ago.
Okay.
And I'd been vegetarian for a very long time before that, for about 20-odd years. And I had a lot of vegan friends and associates who were patiently waiting for me to see the light, I guess. And it was one night when I was at home and I was watching Country Calendar, New Zealand's iconic animal show, agricultural show. And I saw them taking away the calves from the mothers when they'd just been born from the cows. And I was quite upset when I saw the calves on the back of the farmer's truck. And as the farmer closed the gates, the mother cows were basically walking up towards the fence and really looked to me like they wanted their babies back. And just immediately the penny dropped. I was so wrong. How can we be doing this? And I changed overnight to veganism, just like that. And I had wondered how on earth I would have my lattes without cow's milk. But I wouldn't look back now. I could never look back. And I'm really glad I made that change.
Oh, that's great to hear. And do you think it's been easier to be vegan in recent times than when you were first vegan in New Zealand?
Yes, I do. I think when there's a will, there's always a way. And you know, it's easier if you decide to make a change in your life, then you will find a way to adjust. And I think other people who think it's too difficult probably don't have that same drive for that choice, you know, or to make that lifestyle change.
Okay. Well, Chris, when did you decide to be vegan?
Well, I went vegetarian probably nearly 5 years ago. So, and then probably just over 2 years ago, a friend sent me by email a video of animals getting skinned alive on fur farms. And I remember I was so shocked by it. It just affected me very deeply. And I remember actually sometimes lying awake in bed at night, you know, night after night for 2 or 3 weeks, thinking how terrible this was. And in that time, of course, I also started to look on the internet ways to maybe fight against it, to protest or write letters or whatever. And I think gradually I started to learn that it wasn't that kind of cruelty wasn't just confined to that issue of animals getting skinned for their fur. And I gradually realised that in fact by just being vegetarian and still you know, I learned about the dairy industry and about eggs, and I realised. It was a particular point that I decided. I can remember thinking, no, that's the end of it. I don't want anything more to do with this. And I did make that definite decision. I mean, it was not a case of saying, oh, I'll do it gradually. I'm not saying that that's not an okay way for some people, but for me, I'm that kind of person. I knew that I had to draw a line in the sand, and I felt that it was easier to do that as well, like with what Deborah said, that you say that you're not going to do something and that forces you to find alternatives. Whereas if you just do it by half measures, then, you know, it's just a bit too hazy for me and I'm not really like that. So, and for me, you know, I sometimes feel as though compared to some people who, like, for example, Michael and yourself and Deborah, who have been, you know, it's been a long time. They've done it for so long, which is great. And I even feel as though people might think of me that I'm, you know, that I might change or something. And I know myself that I will just never, ever go back. And I think even if I left animal rights activism and maybe I stopped watching videos or something, I still know that that's it for life. I would never, I've seen enough, and I've never even been to farms, you know, but I've seen enough that it's affected me so to know that I would just not want to participate in it ever again.
Okay, well, I myself am only actually a new vegan. I've only been vegan for about 3 years or so. I have been on farms and sort of grew up with it, and I guess maybe to some extent you get inoculated to it. But Chris, do you think it's getting easy to be vegan in New Zealand? I think we have a lot of sort of positive PR about veganism, that a lot of vegans are in high places, and I think a lot of people know what veganism means. I think especially people under the age of, say, 40, I think it seems to be quite common. I have seen videos of people being asked on the street, do you know what a vegan is? And it seems there was sort of an age or generational cutoff for people who did know what veganism was and other ones who had no idea. Do you think it's getting easier to be vegan?
Yeah, quite simply. Yes, it is. Yep. And that can only be good, obviously. I've been out on the street, I've noticed too, just people just know what it is. Even older people, lots of older people, you know, they know what it is too. Yeah, so it's really permeating the society, I think, which is fantastic.
Mm. Well, Michael, you're the last but not the least guest here. When did you decide to become vegan?
I've been vegetarian since 1984, and I think for me it was the inconsistency that I couldn't cope with, because we've had cats in our family since I was two, and we've always treated them like part of the family. And I just couldn't see how it was consistent to treat some animals like members of the family and others as food.
Mm.
So I stopped eating meat pretty much overnight, but I didn't become vegan till 2003. And it had taken me about a year just gradually cutting out milk and eggs before that. Well, eggs was easy, but milk and cheese especially I found harder.
Okay. Did you find a lot of support at first when you decided to be vegetarian and then vegan?
Not at all. In the 80s, I mean, being vegetarian is probably like being vegan a few years ago. I mean, even being vegetarian then was pretty radical. My father would sneer at it. He said it's not food for men. That was the time when Kiwi Jokers and caftan wearers were in the fashion, and he said, oh, you need to put your caftan on. Fortunately, my mother and sister became vegetarian soon after, so he became in the minority.
Oh, that'd be terrible for him.
Yeah, but at university as well, it was... you know, it was considered that we were the problem. If we went away on field trips, we had to cater for the vegetarians, and we were inconsistent, and they kept trying to think of ways that we're inconsistent. That it just seems to, that really annoys me. Mm. Like they say, oh, you do squash mosquitoes.
And do you squash mosquitoes?
if they attack me, it's self-defense. But none of the cows that we eat have ever attacked me or attacked anyone, in fact. Well, if we leave them alone, they'll leave us alone.
Well, it's only up from here, isn't it? There's only going to be more vegans, and people will have time to get used to it, even in places like Southland. I didn't really know when I was vegan. I don't think I'd ever heard of veganism. Had you heard of veganism before you were vegan?
Me?
Yeah.
I first heard of it when I joined Wellington, and wasn't Rainforest Action Group in the 1990s. And they were part of the Peace and Environment Centre, which included Wellington Animal Rights Group.
Okay.
Before that, I was vegetarian. I think it was the first time I'd heard of actually being vegan. I actually didn't think it was possible at that time. I didn't have the nutritional information.
Hmm. Deborah, did you know much about veganism before you were vegan?
I think it was quite a mystery to me. Vegetarianism seemed very, very easy. But as I say, I did have some associates who were vegan, but I just didn't really know much more about it, and I didn't even think to ask, actually. And as a quite a confident vegetarian and very proud of it, I'm almost ashamed of myself now that I didn't even think further into veganism. You know, you're walking around as a vegetarian thinking that you're doing as much as you can for animals. That's why you've made that decision, and yet you were still connected to the abuse of cows and of chickens. So it was really a mystery, but I think now there's a lot more information out there, and people, you know, obviously if they're thinking about becoming vegan, they have got more information for starters than what we probably had, than what, you know, Michael and I had back then.
And Chris, was veganism a big thing before you were vegan?
No, it wasn't. I found going vegetarian harder. I failed once and came back to it a couple of months later. And I think once I'd cut out meat and obviously chicken and fish, I had been a big dairy consumer in terms of milk and ice cream. I loved ice cream. But I knew, it was quite obvious to me that in the supermarkets you could get alternatives. So I thought, well, okay, that's the way to go. And I think the other thing too is that what made me go vegetarian was I was not much of a, at that point, I was not much of an internet user. And so the drive to go vegetarian was more of a nagging feeling that I'd had for years, really, that what I was doing was wrong, that eating meat was wrong. But once I got onto the internet and found out about the abuses of dairy and eggs related to the issue of being vegan, seeing the what happened to the animals and seeing the arguments as well, which I came around to agreeing with too, the reinforcing of that awareness made it easier as well. So it was actually very easy compared to going vegetarian.
You mentioned ice cream. Have you tried the So Good brand?
Yes, I do eat it, a fair amount. It's delicious. It's absolutely fantastic.
What's your favourite of the two flavours? We have two here in Invercargill, at least.
Well, the chocolate.
It's quite interesting. One of our supermarkets, one of our new worlds, it only has the vanilla, and the other one only has chocolate. So you sort of have to travel to get either or. I've mostly had the vanilla, and I vouch for it as well. It's great, and I would think it's some of the best ice cream I've ever had in my life, and it's soy ice cream. Although I might be biased because of being a vegan advocate, and it's been a while since I've had non-vegan ice cream. So I guess alternatives sort of arise when we need them, huh?
It sounds like we're both connoisseurs of ice cream, I know.
So that's two thumbs up.
Yeah, so it's not just, it's not just because it's I'm vegan and I want to like it. I knew what good ice cream was, and I can see no problem with it whatsoever. I think it's at least as good as the taste of the dairy stuff.
Well, I'm glad that we've all found it relatively easy to be vegan now, and I was wondering what we all thought about being vegan now for other people. Is it realistic to promote veganism? And I would personally say I think it's as easy to be vegan as not. Would you agree?
It's not inherently difficult. Like, you've got the recipes out there, the food's there, it's cheaper, your bins don't smell of rotten corpses. I mean, in that way it's easier, but if you're living in mainstream society, and I spent 4 years in Tauranga, which is a sort of provincial backwater, not unlike Invercargill, but maybe without the political excitement, then it is actually quite hard, because at the workplace they don't understand it. They seem to think that, I'll go to a barbecue, we'll just give you a vegetarian sausage on the same barbecue, or, we'll have a big party and we've ordered our meat, and here's a white bread sandwich with some lettuce in, which is what they gave me. It is difficult, and you still get, people aren't so uncouth as to be deliberately insulting, but there's the eye rolling and the sighing and all the, what they call in the racial prejudice field, the micro insults. So yeah, I mean, it is out there. If you're thick skinned and you don't care what people think, or you've got that reasonable high status, then you can live with it. But otherwise, yeah, it is hard.
Deborah or Chris, do you think it's as easy to be vegan as not in New Zealand in 2011?
I think, as I said before, I think it's easy, and I think it's up to us as vegan leaders, really, of the future, to make it not seem difficult to other people. I mean, I constantly get interrogated at work about, how I survive and what I eat and all that sort of thing. And I do think it's important to stand up and be really proud, almost possibly show off, because you are vegan and you've made that change. And just to really keep it simple and not allow people to see it as something that is complicated, because if we put out that kind of message, we're only really steering people away. And we should stand proud, because I think a lot of people would like to be like we are, but they're just not quite sure how to do it. So I do think we are the vegan leaders of the future, and we need to show people the way.
Well, I think there are still a lot of societal pressures against people wanting to take it on. I don't know if I'm too... I mean, personally, I've never found it difficult. Any of the challenges that I hear some people talk about, like not fitting in and stuff like that, perhaps the best way I could answer that would be to say, from a personal point of view, that those things, I'm not trying to gloat or anything, but those issues are never a problem for me, because I'm the kind of person who really likes being different. Like, I grew up listening to music centered around like the punk rock era and that kind of thing, where being different was a virtue. And so for me, thinking about being vegan before I kind of relished it. I thought, yes, here's something I can. And don't get me wrong, that's not the reason I did it. It was purely for the ethics. But it was a sort of a thrill to actually do something that's a bit different.
Okay.
And well, to be seen to be, to be, hey, look at this. So I can walk around and say to people, hey, look at this. This is something different. You should be doing this.
But we are actually up against an agricultural machine in this country. And, we are... I guess, like fish swimming upstream as well. We are fighting a battle, but I don't think it's a losing battle. I think it's a winning kind of battle, but it's and I think we have to stay strong about that, and you know, and that goes with believing in what you're doing and setting an example for other people, really.
Well, then we can be salmon and be leaping up the stream, right? Perhaps, to spawn up the top.
I think there's a virtue in like Deborah said about being strong, like walking tall with it and not being scared of offending. Not that you want to offend and be rude to people, though we're probably going to get onto this later. But you know, to be staunch and to show that it's something that is good, and that we're not going to, you know, that we're not going to move away from it.
But not that we're weak, you know. I mean, some people could see vegan people as being poor little weaklings, or the poor little things, they care about animals, or you know, and they haven't got enough vitamins in their bodies, and they're all little pale creatures. But you know, I think in the past there may have been some bad stereotypes of what vegans might have been, long-haired hippies, all the rest. But you know, the people are coming from all sorts of walks of life, and I'm standing really proud. So that is the thing, and it's about putting that good face and that good image on what we are, so that, as I said before, we can lead by example.
And I think, Jordan, you mentioned before, you know, the New Zealand's history of agriculture and the sporting tradition and that kind of thing. And I really feel instinctively I've felt the time that I've been vegan that for me that's the way to go, to present myself, because I think that people in the mainstream in New Zealand tend to be people who respect people who are more confident about what they're into, and you know, we don't want to be put into this box of being these, you know, weak sort of types who aren't proud of what we are and aren't prepared to fight for what we believe in.
Well, that's good to mention our history, Chris. When I think about my area down here, we were founded by whalers, as they called themselves, people who killed whales, and sealers, you know, people who killed seals. And now in 2011, I think by far the majority of New Zealanders would be shocked with that. We seem to think it's just those awful Japanese people, and it gets quite racist that only the Japanese people have ever killed whales, of course, when so many of our towns and cities and geographic landmarks, they're all named after people who killed whales. Stirling Point here, the very bottom of the South Island. Stirling, he was a whaler. At the Southland Museum and Art Gallery, they have a lot of cooking pots where they cooked whales, and they're cast iron, I think, about the size of a spar pole, say, where they would have put the whale's flesh inside. And this is all around us, and yet we seem to have forgotten that, and it's kind of convenient that we managed to forget that. And things like that, looking at our history, where we've come from, it makes me think of how we have changed and how our whole economy was based around that, about killing the whales and seals here, and how we used to kill sheep a lot, and now we seem to have the conversions into dairy because it was more profitable, and how we have changed over time. And people can say, "Ah, what are you going to do with all you vegans? You're going to ruin our economy, and we're going to run around naked or wearing grass skirts all the time." Well, we've changed before in the past, and I think we can change our economy quite easily to a vegan economy and being more respectful to other animals. I think you'd all agree.
I agree with that.
Yep. So maybe it's also an issue of stereotypes, gender stereotypes. We mentioned that peer pressure and things, I guess those are reasons. And Chris, you mentioned standing up, kia kaha, and being staunch and being proud of who we are, and of not hiding veganism. It's not something to be ashamed of. And I guess a good way to break any of stereotypes like that, in my area, I don't think a few years ago, I don't think many people in Southland had really heard of veganism. I know I hadn't until 3, 4, 5 years ago tops. I don't think I'd ever heard that V word. And I guess the only way to get there is to promote veganism, and I'm quite inspired when I see all the little groups spring up, especially in Hamilton. There's Emmy James and Sam Tucker, and they're quite young, and they're promoting veganism there, and there's William Paul and others in Auckland, and Vish in Wellington. And I hope that you can have Vish on Animal Rights and Wrong sometime soon. It's great with meeting other Wellington vegans.
We did give Vish an invite a week or two ago, but Vish didn't check the emails quite as often as perhaps we do. And so that was a bit sad. But yes, there's always another time.
Can I ask you to estimate how many active vegans would you say there are in the Wellington region? Just a rough guess.
Ooh.
That you know personally.
Oh, maybe personally, probably 45.
Chris and Michael, do you think that's a good number, that you'd know that many vegans that are active?
I just arrived back in Wellington. I've been in Tauranga for the last 4 years. I can tell you there's not many in Tauranga. A few of them do start coming out of the woodwork. They're vegan, but they don't sort of promote it actively.
And Chris?
Yeah, I think Deborah's estimate is pretty accurate. I was in Common Sense today, and I met someone who I'd only recently met who, you know, hasn't been in, I don't think he's been active very long, or hasn't been in Wellington very long. I think that's the main thing. And, you know, it makes me realise that there are people who are active on the social networks, and they are coming to events as well, and they're contributing to stalls. I wonder, Jordan, whether you saw our stall that we did in Wellington a couple of weeks ago. We actively promoted veganism, and while I personally don't regard myself as a straight-out abolitionist, the main thrust of our event in Wellington there was definitely to promote veganism.
Oh, that's very good to hear.
Yeah, and we held up signs and placards in the middle of the street, basically saying, you know, stop the killing, go vegan, that kind of thing.
Well, you definitely have a head start on me here. I joke about starting the Invercargill Vegan Society and about being the only vegan here. I have heard of at least two or three other vegans in Invercargill out of 50,000, and I aim to meet up with them more, and of course we're going to convert them. We're going to use our vegan ray guns and brainwash them from an early age, or whatever we have to do to get more vegans. And I look forward to the time when there's at least 40 active vegans in Invercargill as well.
And is it not a bit like the David in Little Britain? I am the only gay in the village.
No, I'm not pretending, sadly, although there are at least two others.
Yeah.
No, you can't be vegan. I'm the only vegan in Invercargill. It's fun to joke about that as well. It doesn't get that explicit here. I'm looking forward to being as popular and having as many vegans here as in Wellington. And I'd just like to mention, Chris, you suggested promoting veganism, and how do you think that went, promoting veganism?
Well, it went really well. We had quite a lot of people turn up, and it just felt great to be doing that. And I think it goes along with what some of us have felt recently, that it is in the media more. And I personally think you have to take advantage of that and maybe take a few chances, you know, and push it a bit more. And sure, it's going to alienate some people, but I think sometimes you have to remember that you may be doing a better job of reaching people who are thinking about it. And if you just carried on with the stuff that is a bit too welfare oriented, then you might miss out on encouraging those people to take the extra step.
Well, it's a bit like different strokes for different folks, isn't it? And, you know, you might be working with a group like Safe on the Streets, and you'll have certain types of people that might be happy to come up and talk with you, or for you to approach them. But you might have other abolitionist type people who would say, well, no, that's not enough for me. And maybe they approached you, Chris, on the stall, I don't know. But I think that with having lots of different groups doing lots of different things, we have a better opportunity to target the different types of personalities that are out there as well. Whereas if we just have one particular type of group and think that we're going to get our message out to everybody all at the same time, I don't really think that's going to work. So I do think it is good to have, you know, groups that are promoting. The bottom line probably is veganism for most groups, but the you know, it's all in the way that it's done and how different people will receive that information. So I think that was a good idea with what Chris did, because that hasn't been done in Wellington for quite a while.
Chris, do you think people were more or less negative if you were promoting a welfare thing, to say for larger cages or a certain type of facility, as opposed to promoting veganism? Do you think non-vegans, do you think they react harsher if you promote veganism, or is it easier for them to understand, or how do you think non-vegans generally deal with it?
I don't know about the degree of their response, but I think a larger number of people are more supportive if it's a softer message centred around welfare.
We're not actually advocating larger cages. What we're advocating is saying, get rid of cages.
Sorry.
And I do notice, and there is a difference. It was the government that wanted the larger cages. They wanted to bring in from 450 square centimetres to, you know, a credit card size bigger, and then they wanted to have a bit of enrichment in cages. But the message that SAFE and other people, including the SPCA, are actually pushing is let's get rid of cages.
I do understand that. I was interested in seeing about the barn raised and all the... Did anyone else hear that? That was very loud, 8 o'clock. Hey everyone, it's Jordan from the future. Here in the year 2025, at least one man is still alive after the fifth nuclear war with Australia. The Allied nations were devastated, leaving much of the Earth's surface a barren, dusty crap hole with no mountains or lakes, nowhere to shoot the remake of those old Lord of the Rings and Hobbit movies. Oh yeah, you guys will probably remember them from when they were just, you know, they just came out in your recent history. Well, trust me, it's much better seeing them in 8D on your Apple holodeck, or other corporations putted out of existence in the early 2020s. A barren, dusty crap hole, you know, just how Australians like it. But before our Australian overlords return to give this New Zealander a thermostatic beating, let me be clear, nobody else heard, "It's 8 o'clock," coming from Alex, the voice on my iMac. Perhaps it's like what the doc keeps telling me. Don't share the voices inside your head what they're telling you to do, be it 6, 7 or even 8 o'clock. They didn't hear it. It's all in your head, if you're wearing headphones. And up the dosage. What did show up in the recording was a guy making a fool of himself. Well, stay well, my friends in 2011. You know, many of you won't make it to 2025. Enjoy your time. Dennis, yes you, keep an eye out for a speeding green Nissan in 2014, okay? And whatever you do, don't let Australia get the bomb. Just nuke the continent from orbit. It's the only way to be safe. Taking the DeLorean back to 88 miles per hour, oh, get this, it's American-made now, and those Americans still haven't caught up with the metric system. Even after President Jobs modernised architectural design, they still use miles. See ya. Okay, it's good to know it's 8 o'clock. I've seen about the different barn-raised operations and what can be classed as free range overseas, and I generally find it very upsetting. And I do think that if we say that they're going to live in a barn or in a fenced area, it is a larger cage of sorts. It's just a degree of how much space is given. I do find it interesting, but I know when I've walked past the bird's egg section at the supermarket, and it's made me feel really sad recently after seeing campaigns for cage-free, let's say, to see a mother talking to her daughter about, these are the good eggs and these, they don't hurt the hens, and it makes me really sad to hear that as someone who looks after my little hen friends in the backyard, that this little girl is being sort of indoctrinated that this is right and this is a good thing to be doing and that they don't hurt these hens. And it's one of the few times I always have my cards with me, my business cards, and they have some websites on them from my website and my friends, and just more sources of vegan information, and it's all gentle and friendly stuff. And it was one of the only times in recent memory that I haven't actually given them the card, because I just felt so sad, and I was there by myself, a strange young man, wearing my work overalls with I'm vegan and I love you on them, and I thought it would be a rather intimidating thing to say, actually, what you've heard is wrong, and they do hurt them horribly, and I just didn't know how to deal with it. How dare you think it works when we promote two messages? Do you think they are complimentary all the time?
I don't think we are promoting two messages. No, SAFE have never said buy free range or buy barn eggs, as far as I'm aware.
Right. Yeah, and when you say we, you know, I'm not sure who you mean. I think maybe the SPCA have been, or the RNZ SPCA may have been a bit more responsible for that, because they're the ones that have been prepared to put their stickers on free range products or on barn products. But when you say we, I think you've got to be careful. I don't think it's SAFE, as Michael says, that is doing that. There's nowhere where they have said, you know, go and buy free range products, but the SPCA do seem to be the ones that are endorsing certain types of food producers. So, yeah, I'm just a bit concerned that people are blaming SAFE for that sort of approach.
I wouldn't like to blame SAFE, and we're speaking for ourselves here.
Yeah.
I'm not bringing SAFE into it, but I have seen. I was looking at one of the videos recently about McDonald's going free range. Do you remember that story? I think it was from about a year ago.
Yeah.
I remember sort of Hans at that it was a good thing, the free range. And I have seen sort of the mention of free range only cafes that only stock the good eggs, so to speak. It gets mentioned. And I am good friends with SAFE and Vicargo. I often go to the meetings and they're all good friends with me. They know I disagree about promoting veganism or the welfare reforms on the way. And the last time I was there, they were talking about how they were arranging suppliers for restaurants. And I found that really upsetting, the idea that they were going to farms and they were organising the bestials to get the free-range eggs and the free-range flesh and stuff. It was quite sad, I thought.
Who was actually doing that? Was that safe in Invercargill?
Invercargill, yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised at that, actually. And I'd like to find out a bit more about that they would be organising that sort of thing, really. Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, that's not the business of SAFE, to be organising supplies of eggs to, you know, retailers or restaurants, obviously. So I'm a bit surprised to hear that.
So I guess we could mention the other thing we mentioned about changing stereotypes in the ARW episode. It mentioned Mike King. How do we all think Mike King's been doing with acting as a spokesman, let's say?
Well, I think he's connected with Middle New Zealand, really, hasn't he? Do you think so, Michael?
I know SAFE have been using vegan celebrities for ages, including Emily Barclay, who I think is a lot more talented as well as a lot sexier than Mike King, but had no traction. And as soon as Mike King came along, you know, we got traction. We got the sows out of the sow crates by 2015. And that means that pig farmers who are looking at bringing in sows now are thinking twice, because they have to, if they want to go free range, they have to get resource consent. So that's going to cost them money. So there's going to be fewer pig farming, even now. And then after 2015, they'll be out of the sow crates. And yes, I know that they still suffer in the farrowing crates, and I know that free-range pigs are still suffering. I hear that from free-range farmers, oddly enough, who say that, you know, free-range pigs don't have a particularly good time. But it is, again, a start. And for the pigs, they'll prefer to be out of the cages than in them. And I think it's also sent up the pork board as being, you know, a bunch of greedy capitalist pigs who are not really interested in anything else but money. And pork sales of pork have gone down. That can only be a good thing. The pork board themselves are worried about the price of pork and how it's going to go up. If the price of pork goes up, people will buy less of it. You know, and okay, King's not a vegan, but he never pretended to be, and SAFE never pretended that he represented SAFE.
I think the ads actually said that explicitly, and thanks Mike King for the success and things, but I would look forward to having all vegan celebrities though promoting it, and I just wonder if we can be all our own role models. I think maybe it's a different way, rather than I've seen some people talk about, we can talk about in America might be easier, they mentioned the sort of vegan celebrities who turn out not to be vegan. I think Alicia Silverstone and all those ones for Peter. They normally tend to be younger women, and they normally tend to be have some kind of slip up or something, and it turns out to be sort of a minor controversy.
Well, not all of them. Not all of them, to be fair. You said all of them. I think it's a bit.
I think most of them would generally. Could you think of many of the most well known ones that turn out to be?
Well,
actually,
why are we only talking about the young women? I mean, we could talk about
other
people.
All
we could
them, sure.
talk about other people who have represented Peter, and you could include Bryan Adams. You could include. I don't know.
I think Bryan Adams was one that he mentioned having a farm. Was that Sting and Bryan Adams? One of them that was, yeah, he turned out to having a farm, and that, yeah, he had to do something with them, and so ended up killing the animals there because, yeah.
I'd actually love to see that. I wouldn't love to see that, but I'd love to see where you got that from, because from what I've seen, I mean, maybe I'm being too, you know, too naive and trusting, but from the quotes and that I've seen of Bryan Adams, who, in his words, has been vegan since 1989, and hey, I'm not even a fan of his music.
Is he on here?
I'm surprised to hear that, and I just think that, you know, so sure, there are slip-ups, just as people in ordinary society slip up, and I don't think we should praise them more.
Hey again, it's Future Jordan from the year 2025. Using our future resources to do an autopsy on the so-called vegan celebrities of your time, it did turn out most were not actually vegan. However, like the, did anyone else hear it's 8 o'clock? But I was somewhat wrong again. It wasn't Bryan Adams I was thinking of, it was Sting, a man often said to be vegan, and used as a cool vegan superhero. This is a quote from www.ivu.org, the International Vegetarian Union, who again quote everyone's favourite animal rights group, PETA. Gurus to Sting for telling the Miami Herald, about 5 years ago we built an organic farm. Part of animal husbandry is that they breed, and you can't keep them all. So I started eating meat again, but I only eat the animals I raise. I won't eat an animal that comes from a slaughterhouse. It is not clear whether Sting was ever fully vegetarian in the past. I apologise to Brian Adams, who may or may not have ever been vegan. Our futuristic autopsy kits were unable to locate his body after the fourth nuclear war with Australia. Sting is definitely not vegan. I guess we all know what has to be done. He needs to be officially de-vegan.
What are you talking about?
You just drank half and half, baby.
Freeze! Vegan police! Vegan police!
Todd Ingram, you're under arrest for veganity violation. Code number 827. And vibe and a half and half.
It's bull roar!
No vegan diet, no vegan powers!
But it's only my first offense, so don't I get three strikes? I mean,
take it. 12:27 a.m. on February 1st, you knowingly ingested gelato.
Gelato isn't vegan.
It's milk and eggs, bitch. On April 4th, 7:30 p.m., you partook a plate of chicken parmesan.
Chicken isn't vegan?
The de-vegan egg's ready. Hit him!
You once were a vegan, but now you will be gone.
Vegan?
Damn straight, that took the sting out of his tail, eh? Not vegan? Then no more marathon sessions of tantric sex for you.
You know, and I think, you know, I think there's something wrong too with the celebrity thing. I don't think it's, I'm not 100% in support of that either, but I think it's still something there that's, that can be useful. I think it has its down, it has its negative side. Talking about the Mike King thing, I think that the identification that people in mainstream New Zealand, as Deborah and Michael talked about, have had with him, I wonder, I just think, it's difficult to know some of these groups, how much effort they put into, you know, studies or and thought into the strategy and that as to how long it's going to take to try to get a change in people's mindset towards animals and their empathising with their suffering and their and what we hopefully would hope comes about, that they eventually agree that the animals should have the rights that we think they should have to be able to live out their lives without being exploited and killed. But and I wonder how long that's going to take. And I still think that some of these things like the celebrity stuff and the Mike King, they have a part to play in softening or rather making people who really, unlike us, don't seem to have much empathy for animals. But over time, affecting some sort of change and getting them to slowly wake up. And
yeah, that's Chris,
And that's why I don't regard my. I like a lot of the abolitionist arguments, but I still don't accept the whole argument, and I still think that there is a place for some welfare. It's not what I want to do, and it's not what I'm comfortable doing. Just as Deborah said, you know, I'm comfortable doing the vegan thing because I think the time is right, and I think Safe. I actually think Safe should be doing more vegan stuff. I think they should be coming out more about it. But I still don't think. I still think, as Deborah said, I think that there's a place for both. I think for me, it's a matter of the balance as to how much there is. So, yeah.
It's also a matter of personal attitudes. I mean, if you are not comfortable with doing welfare, then don't do it. Do the abolitionist thing. But if you are, then, you know, don't put down people who happen to see things differently. I know that the meat industry are actually more worried about the welfare reforms in place, both in New Zealand, according to a 1997 study by MAF, and according to a Kansas study in America, than they are abolitionist vegans, simply because there's so many more people who are just, you know, cutting down on meat or only eating meat that comes from free range. And okay, even if they're not treated any better, the fact that they're buying the more expensive meat and not eating as much means fewer animals are being killed. And I think in this case, we can listen to the industry because the industry know what's threatening their bottom line.
I think also that the Mike King events actually spoke for themselves. I know it's hard to measure, but I do honestly believe that if Mike King hadn't have come along, South would probably be in crates for a heck of a lot longer if we only took the abolitionist approach with that. So while that may be the eternal goal, I think that's probably just managed to cut down the amount of time that the pigs are in the sow crates. So, it can only be measured by
that sort of success, I guess, you know, to have got that result in that draft code, when that draft code was analysed and completed and all sorted out. Yeah, because we did talk about measuring the approach of animal rights groups the other day and how they can get success and how they can change shoppers' habits. And I don't think we really know. I don't think we've really got that sort of information, but the Mike King episode, as I said, spoke for itself and we saw a change there. It might not be the ultimate change. People are still going to eat pork, but as Michael said, the pigs would rather be out of the crates than in them.
I do think it's interesting. I wish Lindsay could be here as well. She made a point when she came to New Zealand. I think she mentioned 2002.
Yeah.
That it was quite difficult to get soy milk. Do you guys remember that?
Yes. I remember that, and I lived in Lower Hutt, so I know exactly what she's talking about too. But I think that's still the same in some of the small towns. You only have to travel around the country, and sometimes it's really, really hard to get yourself a soy latte. That's still happening in this country even now. So you tend to be a wise vegan and pack your own and you take it with you.
And it's still happening now, you said, Michael?
In Tauranga, yeah, it's difficult to get a soy latte.
It's never been a problem for me here, but I'm not a coffee drinker. Okay, I do think it's interesting, though, the idea that it certainly the major chains throughout the country, soy milk and the like, tofu and products I'd probably never even heard of before I was vegan or vegetarian. As they're becoming more common, I suppose, as we promote veganism, there'll be more of them and there'll be more vegan restaurants as well. So I do think it is a tipping point that way. If we, just as we make more of a demand as consumers, I think the money does have quite a big talk, supply and demand. And I do think it will be interesting to see more products available. I remember even just in the last few years, there seemed to be more brands of soy milk. Until recently, it was all just So Good here, which I think that's a sanitarian brand.
Yep.
I think there's quite a few smaller ones now, Vitasoy and at least one or two more. So,
can I just say that the thing about soy milk, though, I don't think it's just being driven by an animal rights perspective.
Oh, no, I don't either. Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of people, you know, choose soy for health, don't they? But, you know, I mean, when we're talking about measuring our success of our campaigns and all those sorts of things, we can still measure it with some of the other things like the vegetarian sausages or the more tofu products, or the fact that just about most restaurants in the city that you go to either have a vegan or vegetarian meal on the menu. So we can kind of measure it in that kind of way, where we are starting to see that people are prepared to provide for us a lot more. So, you know, in Wellington, I was talking to a bar manager recently, and he said that the owners of this particular bar were considering opening a restaurant and bar, like a funky restaurant and bar that was solely vegetarian and possibly vegan. I mean, that's incredibly exciting in Wellington City that we may get that. And I can't name the name of the company that's talking about it, but I know that the owners of the bar, their daughter's vegan. So she's obviously had their influence. They have vegan menu. And that's like, oh my God, that's so exciting for me. I'm, you know, we must be having an effect out there, but it is hard to measure it, you know, if you really wanted to.
Well, I don't measure my success in promoting veganism here or the veganism, vegans promoting veganism in New Zealand in terms of soy milk brands on the shelves, but I think it's just good to see more businesses opening and more companies and more products being available available nationwide. I think it's a great way.
Yeah.
And I saw earlier tonight that Subway is now the world's largest restaurant brand and it overtook McDonald's. And I think that's quite incredible to think about recently too. So many decades ago, well, only in my lifetime even, fish and chips were the standard thing throughout the whole, definitely in the South Island. And we didn't have Subway or Burger King in Invercargill until recently, and it's just sort of times changed, and now people can't imagine not having them. So for Subway, which people see as a health-conscious option, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, they mention the veggie delight, the vegan thing. It's quite exciting to think that people get used to a new idea and that it can overtake the likes of McDonald's, and now we can look forward to more vegan options, which Subway do have more vegan options, I believe.
Have they actually got a vegan option, or is it just a veggie patty?
The veggie patty is vegetarian, I believe. It's got milk or it's got eggs in it or something.
So what are the vegan options apart from...
basically, to have a plain sandwich, I believe, is pretty much it at the moment. But it's I think it's easier than, say, McDonald's. I don't really think, can I have the Big Mac without anything that's not vegan? I think it's more of a realistic option than that. And it is exciting to see as more products and brands become available. Mm. And with more options, I think Elizabeth Collins mentions in Auckland, she's often promoting veganism with William Paul, her friend, and they do a really great job. And I think most people listening would know about them, but you can find them at nzveganpodcast.blogspot.com. They promote veganism each and every weekend whenever they can. And they get out there in Altea Square and they promote veganism, and they mentioned a man that he made his fortune selling hot dogs, sausages, and he was really listening and really receptive to them about veganism, and so he's thinking about starting it up in New Zealand as well and having it all vegan. He might not even mention that they're not vegan, the sausages. So I do think it's exciting.
I think there's huge, actually, business opportunities out there for the veganism movement, really. And I think a lot of people, probably a lot of us, are a little bit slow at realising that. But it's obvious that the world is starting to ask more. And, you know, we are, as I said earlier, we are the leaders of the future. And we are setting that example. And people are starting to see that they do see veganism as cool. They don't see it as old-fashioned, hippie, sort of downtrodden stuff. They're thinking, oh, my goodness, what are we missing out on? We're not checking out what these guys are doing. And more people want to know about it. Once they know about why we've done it, they want to jump on the bandwagon. And that's obvious with the growth of vegetarians and vegans that I've got to know in Wellington here. You know, last year at the Vegetarian Society festival, it was massive. It was huge. I couldn't believe that even there were that many vegetarians in town, or that there was even that kind of interest. So I think that, the opportunities are rife out there, and if many of us are smart, we'll jump onto them.
Okay.
I've been away from Wellington for 4 years. Now I've come back, there's a lot more vegans and a lot bigger vegan movement with more mature and sort of better thought out strategies. But I wonder how much of that is simply because we've kicked out the spies and the divisive elements.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting to look at all that kind of subterfuge.
Michael, there may always be more spies, you just don't know who they are yet.
Spies.
Yeah, are you trying to tell us something, Deborah?
Well, I did go to a fancy dress party as 99, but no, it's not me.
Just thinking, if we want to promote veganism, a lot of people are convinced by the rational arguments. They say, okay, yeah, you're right, for animal cruelty reasons, for environmental reasons, for health reasons, I should go vegan. But what do I do? I've got no experience being vegan. I've all my life I've been brought up with meat and two veggies. My cooking classes at school were all about meat. How do I start? I think we need to actually be prepared for more sort of practical vegan education in that way, you know, just basic cooking and catering.
Hmm. I think Lindsay mentioned that you've got to have it, is how she put it. And yes, I do think it's quite easy to have it. I often carry some recipes when I'm talking with people. I don't generally carry many paper pamphlets. I prefer to redirect them to a website or a podcast. But I am getting more used to carrying pamphlets with me now. And I think we can thank the internet for that. It makes it so much easier to share recipes and the like. Don't you agree?
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, I think we can make quite a big difference there. And I suppose to go back to more vegan options that are out there, I guess as there's more mock analog meats, as they call them, I guess some people will often just continue their diet and just replace the products with something else. But hopefully they can move to less processed options as well. And I'm quite optimistic about that, and I do think it's quite exciting to see all the small vegan societies and associations that we have. And a lot of them are in the North Island, but there's quite a few in the South Island as well. And so it's always good to stay in contact with other vegans. And
I think that a green smoothie every day is a really good idea, especially for vegans who, like I used to be, and sometimes I still go back to that, eating a lot of the processed stuff. I now treat those foods as a treat themselves. What I've done to make, I mean, I would never go back to not being vegan. There's no way. But I feel I've often said to people that I've almost instituted a sort of a secondary barrier between going, you know, if I ever was, so that I try to stay away from the inverted commas junk vegan food, and to sort of, you know, regard those as treats. And my staple, the staple part of my diet is basically the raw fruit and vegetables. And I think, you know, I actually think some of the health, negative health effects, people say that the the meat analogues and that aren't that healthy. I think when you're off the very unhealthy aspects of the animal diet, the cholesterol and the saturated fat and the animal protein, I think that sometimes the health detriment of those products is overstated, because I think that if, as long as you're eating a reasonable amount of fruit and vegetables in your diet, you're doing pretty well. So
we didn't actually talk about very much about the free range products and happy eggs and happy pork and stuff like that. But as far as the promoting of veganism goes, I guess in the connection with that is that while some people don't like the approach towards free range products, I think that when you are talking about whatever aspect of animal agriculture that you're talking about, you are opening the door to making people think. So even if someone's going to eat a free-range egg or free-range pork, you can then actually, it actually gives you another opportunity to say, well, that might be good, but did you also know this? So I think that people shouldn't completely shun the fact that, or be disappointed that people are probably buying free-range products. I think it, you know, seize the moment and grab that opportunity as well to also explain to people, well, did you know that that hen's still going to get shackled up and have her throat cut? Did you know that the piglets are only going to be 3 months old before they're slaughtered for bacon? Stuff like that. And I, so I think that people should take heart in that, and no matter what organisations are running, you know, different campaigns, still see it as an opportunity to educate people that little bit further, because they've already thought about the animal when they decide they're going to choose free range. You just have that chance to take them that next step further.
Okay. I can see your point there. I just personally remember, like, I can look at my chicken friends. I talk about them. I always call them my friends. I don't agree with pets or calling them anything like that. They've always been my friends. And I do think we can get a lot greater results just by talking about other animals, as other animals, rather than us and animals, and always being careful about the terms that we use. I prefer not to use words like meat. I normally say flesh or leather. I don't like saying leather. I normally say skin. I guess my new thing is not saying egg so much. I might be saying bird's eggs, just to make it sound, it sounds rather odd having bird's eggs, isn't it, rather than eggs, which is seems so standard when you see it on a refrigerator. It's got the egg compartment, or it sounds so much more everyday. And I do think we can get a really good response by talking about friendship and talking about just basic respect for other animals. And I do worry that promoting different degrees or shades of grey, I do worry. I think about the mother and her daughter in the supermarket, and they were talking about these are the good ones, and I felt really, it was about the first time I've ever really felt uncomfortable promoting veganism, when I realised they really wouldn't like me to go over there and tell them you're wrong. And no matter how I said it, they'd probably see it as quite intimidating. If I said, well, for example, do you know that they cut their beaks off and it hurts them, and they grind up all the male chicks because they're useless because they don't lay eggs? I think they really would have taken it quite negatively, and I just felt so sad, and I wished that they could have always heard about veganism instead.
But that reminds me of being vegetarian and thinking that I was so wonderful, that I was doing all the right things by animals, and yet really I hadn't gone the whole way to becoming vegan. So it was almost like a stepping stone for me, and maybe if I'd been to veganism 28 years ago, I would have absolutely shrieked and thought, no way. I do agree. I would rather people just completely cut it out. But, you know, we have to understand that people, you know, move in different ways, and we can't expect them all to react like we do when they get that information. So I see it as opening of a door. I wish they wouldn't just sort of go halfway and go the whole hog straight away. But, you know, if it gets them thinking and it takes them down the road a little bit further later on, it's a good thing.
Yeah, I do focus on my chicken friends, and I just use them as kind of, they're who I think of when I talk about veganism. And I just think about Mr. Rooster and the hens. I think about how I'd like them to be treated. And so when I'm promoting veganism, I see it as talking about my friends, other animals. I do think veganism is the least they deserve. So it was really interesting to talk with you. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. It's been a big day. We've heard lots of big news about Osama bin Laden and war and fighting, and is it a victory or not?
It's changed from royal wedding, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a big change there. I was thinking, you know, I could have almost put up with anything but this damn royal wedding all the time. But
did you see what was on their dinner menu?
Oh, what was on their dinner menu?
Well, they had lamb.
Oh, great, they had lambs.
Ways, I believe.
Lovely.
Baby sheep, you mean? I call it baby sheep.
Well, it's a lamb, yeah, it's a baby. Yeah, terrible.
They're a baby, yeah.
And it didn't say that there were any vegetarian options, and there must have been for 300-odd people.
I hope there are vegan options.
Pardon? Oh, sorry, yeah, vegan options. Yeah, it wasn't mentioned in the paper, but I'm sure it was there.
So, yeah, I do think there's a big thing to just promoting friendship and other animals as friends and not calling them its. I know I slip into it as well, but that they're not a thing, that they're a he or a she, they're sentient beings. And I do think we are really going places with promoting veganism. And I thank you all very much, Michael and Deborah and Chris. Thank you all very much for having your radio show in Wellington. And
Tom, can I just mention one thing? On the Yahoo webpage yesterday, there was something about some new ethical journal or something, and it said that animals shouldn't be called pets anymore. They should be cared for.
Yeah, I saw that.
Have animal carers rather than be pets or be owned. So it is terminology is being changed in the mainstream, but people were thinking that people that were worried about not calling their little Fifi a pet might be nutters. So
yes, I have seen that thing. I don't promote that. They say about you're going to have to ask permission when you take pictures of wildlife animals because you're violating their rights. And Gary Francione, a law professor, and he points that out. You know, he thinks it's quite ridiculous that people take it to that extreme. And he would know, being that's his field, he doesn't get involved with that kind of thing. But yes, I do think most people can understand. They mention members of the family for the family cat and the family dog, as they say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a little odd to have another species in your family. I can understand friendship much easier. The family tree would be a bit odd otherwise. And I do think we get really great results. And thank you all for joining me. And I'm sure a lot more people other than myself listen to your show outside of Wellington. So thank you for doing your show as well.
Thank you.
I'm glad Chris, Deborah and Michael could join me for my show. I'd like to explain my zany subway analogy. Rather than asking for McDonald's to kill other animals better, welfare reform, I was trying to say people can get used to a new corporation, new food, a new idea, that it can indeed overtake McDonald's, the industry leader for decades and in a short time, too. We don't need to tinker around the edges and regulate atrocities. We can promote a new business, a new chain, a new idea, or newfound respect for animals from the ground up. And in a short time, really become mainstream, indeed, overtake the mainstream, to be well established, and rake in lush third quarter profits. And if we start taking off, with our message of respect for all animals, and the dominant restaurant notices and tries to win back customers with, hey, we're kind to the ingredients before we kill it, ads, that's to be expected. Let's keep on being ourselves, on being animal rights activists, or keep being me, like everyone's favourite Canadian rapper would say. What am I doing? Oh yeah, that's right, I'm doing me, I'm doing me. I'm living life right now, man, and this is what I'ma do till it's over, till it's over. But it's far from over. Yeah, that's right, I'm doing me, I'm doing me. I'm living life right now, man, and this is what I'ma do till it's over, till it's over. But it's far from over. Well, this episode is over, all nearly 2 hours of it. Thank you for listening to Coexisting with Non-Human Animals. You can find the script for this episode, as well as downloads for every episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals at coexistingwithnonhumananimals.co.nz. To show off how fancy I am, I've been using Bitly links for each episode, a shortcut to each episode's script and resources. For this show, episode 53 sources, just go to www.bit.ly/coexist53. If you want to contact me, even just to say you've listened, send an email to jwontdart@gmail.com or on Twitter, if you're one of the 5 people in the world still using it, twitter.com/jaywontdart. I'd appreciate it. I think I can also be found on that Facebook thing, Jordan Wyatt or J Won't Dart. Thank you for listening.
Away from the notion of animals as things and toward the moral personhood of animals. The choice is ours. If you're not vegan, go vegan. It's easy. It's better for you. It's certainly better for the planet. And and most importantly, it's the morally right thing to do.